Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? Every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. In National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said. Now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted. Inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved. Because malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan, it was just if the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. And the people died. Then they died some more. They drowned inside their attics, an army of the poor, an army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember those sad and awful days when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. 500,000 refugees. Here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth. Where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards. Where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Lindsay Burstein interview Rachel Godsill about race. You can listen to this program at 96.5 FM if you're in the Sacramento area, or you can listen to it at accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And I feel the conventional wisdom also feeds into it, that it's not just that people are supposed to interrogate their own privilege intellectually and realize that they have all these unearned attributes and privileges and good things, but also to constantly be mentally referring to it and have that be a thought that's really foremost in your mind if you're being a good social justice ally, about constantly checking your privilege as an ongoing thing.
Right. And I think what this social science suggests is what more important than checking your privilege is actually, like as I suggested, looking beyond ourselves. And there's a wonderful set of interventions that Patricia Devine from the University of Wisconsin has identified called Breaking the Prejudice Habit, that this social science would suggest should be put in place of the sort of white privilege mantra. And instead, we should be focused on breaking our prejudice habit, because that's very outward-looking. We should be thinking about how our behavior and how our treatment, essentially, of the people around us, how it affects them. And what these interventions do is they essentially give a really helpful set of steps that we can take in order to reduce our biases. And what they involve are, A, recognizing that we often carry these stereotypical associations about people of other groups, and think about how our actions might reflect those. So an example might be, you know, a white woman who inadvertently, or sort of without even realizing it, you know, holds her purse tighter or sort of flinches when an African-American man walks by her, to realize that we're doing that. So to be mindful of what our behavior looks like, how our behavior is affecting someone else, because that, you know, the guy who just walked by us and saw us flinch, his day is now clouded by this very hurtful notion that he's presumed to be criminal or dangerous in some way. Instead of checking your privilege, check your behavior, and then doing the work of identifying counter-stereotypic images and ideas and people, hopefully from the world that you live in, but not necessarily a lot. You know, a lot of whites continue to live in fairly homogeneous environments, so you might need to reach beyond your immediate environment and reach to either media figures or people you've read about or friends of friends. It turns out that racial bias can actually be reduced just by knowing that people they're close to have close relationships with people of other races, extended contact, which is kind of amazing.
Do you think it's possible that the knowledge of having a black president has changed Americans in some measurable way for the better in that sense?
So that's obviously the hope. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that it's done that yet. I think among this generation of youth, it certainly may, because it will have been commonplace to think of a black president from the time that they were young. But the one thing, and this is where the breaking the prejudice habit steps are useful, the one risk that we have in just sort of assuming that we have a black president and therefore that's going to alter stereotypical associations about black men is there's always been a sense of exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy for people to accept the idea that a person can be excellent and a person of another race can be excellent. But what sometimes happens is inadvertently in people's minds, and this is all happening, you know, sort of implicitly, is someone becomes the exceptional and they're somehow like put into a different category than everybody else of their race. And so this is where the work of breaking the prejudice habit requires two additional steps. You identify counter-stereotypic images, ideas, people in your mind, so you have those available when you actually are interacting with someone who's a person of color. But then you also learn, instead of trying to be colorblind, which is what we're sort of taught we're supposed to be, we actually have to work to notice all the individual differences within people who fit within the big category of the particular racial group. So another challenge that whites often have is individuating among people of other racial groups, because I think we're afraid to actually look at people and see, oh, this person has, you know, sort of chestnut brown skin and this kind of hair, and this person has, you know, a lighter colored skin. Like, we're embarrassed to even think that way in our minds because that seems like noticing race too much.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing wrong with noticing someone's race. That's who they are, and they're not embarrassed about it. They're generally, you know, have a lot of pride in who they are, and that's very much part of their identity. But for whites, that feels very uncomfortable. And so it's part of breaking the prejudice habit is getting over the anxiety that noticing race is what makes us a racist. And then finally, engaging in what they call sort of empathic perspective taking. So what often happens now, we think of as like stepping into someone's shoes, is you think, well, what would I do if I were in that situation? Well, gee, if, you know, I were walking down the middle of the street and a police officer told me to get onto the sidewalk, I would just get onto the sidewalk. I don't understand why this person in Ferguson refused to get on the sidewalk. But that's, of course, not being empathic. That's thinking, what would I do given my life experience and how, you know, police have treated me and what it's always been like? If instead we sort of work harder to really think about what has the person's experience been like? What would it feel like to have had those experiences, to have had, you know, police officers hassling you regularly from the time that you're 10 years old? Like, how would that change your reaction to police officers? What might feel different in that moment? That can really kind of help overcome the sort of very polarized way that people often see the same situation. And then finally, having as much interracial contact as we can find in our own circles, in our own communities. And what Patricia Devine found is people who did all four of those things, so identifying when they were responding based on stereotypes, making more accessible images of people and ideas of people who didn't fit stereotypes, really working to individuate within a particular racial group and then really engage in an empathic perspective taking where you really think about what someone's life has been like, that actually reduced people's prejudice levels. And if you're taking the implicit association test, it reduced your bias score and people expressed more concern and awareness of discrimination. And most excitingly, really, is the people who did that work were enthusiastic about having interracial interactions instead of anxious or avoidant. And so this is why I suggest instead of this interrogating our privilege, let's actually look at our behavior and then think about more consciously about how it feels to be in another racial group to the point that we can engage with people in another racial group without it feeling weird and awkward. Because that weird awkwardness, the racial anxiety, actually is meaningful when, again, in a lot of contexts, but particularly when there's the power differential, when you have someone who's either the doctor or the nurse or the teacher.
How does stereotype threat play into all this?
So stereotype threat, the general idea is the warrior concern that one is going to confirm a negative stereotype about your group. So stereotype threat, it was initially identified in the context of academic achievement. It's been looked at with African-American and Latino students in taking standardized tests. And Claude Steele and Josh Aronson, who were two of the first researchers to identify it, because they couldn't understand why these incredibly brilliant students they had at Stanford weren't performing nearly as well as they would have expected on the GRE and going to grad school and sort of achieving what they thought they would achieve. And so they hypothesized that when people are taking a really difficult test, if there's a little anxiety in the back of your mind that you might confirm a negative stereotype, that anxiety makes inaccessible all of your academic and mental capacity. And it won't matter if you're taking easy tests, but it will matter if you're taking something like the GRE or the LSAT or the MCAT or something that's incredibly difficult and requires, every ounce of mental ability and agility that you have. And so they tested it by having one group of students take a difficult portion of the verbal GRE, and they said to that group of students, this is the verbal GRE, this tells you, sort of how capable you are and how likely you are to get to grad school and to be successful if you go into grad school, and they called it the diagnostic test. And they gave another group of students the exact same test, but they said, we're not interested in what your score is, we're interested in how it feels to be taking a difficult test. In order for us to measure that, you have to do your best, because otherwise how you feel when taking the test isn't valid. Both groups were given pizza at the end or something, sort of happy at the end, and they found that the scores of African-American students in the diagnostic group were significantly lower than the scores of the African-American students in the how do you feel when you're taking a standardized test group, the non-diagnostic group. And so these were people who otherwise had identical academic records, and the significant difference in performance could be explained only by one group thinking it's measuring their capacities and the other group not being worried that it measured their capacities. This has now been replicated with gender and with other racial groups, including white men who are taking a math test when they're just taking a math test, and white men who are told before they take a math test that they're being measured against how Asian Americans perform in the math test.
All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll admit that there have been some problems in the White House, but there is one problem around here that is definitely going to get fixed. Here, buddy, here, boy. Come on, buddy. Here he is. Hey, how's my buddy? Oh, no, wait. Stop, get off there, that's federal evidence. Oh, down. Ladies and gentlemen, my buddy.
A great female I'll never get when that he-male takes me to the vet. 'Cause to be male you need a full set. So never forget, you've gotta have parts. Getting neutered really smart. And don't apply to be a puppy intern. That's where the trouble starts. It won't be much fun. I'll feel testy when it's done. And doing this to any dog who's a mutt's totally nuts. No pun. They can't re-glue them or re-stick them. They'll be thrown out in a pan. Just last week I learned to lick them. Like they say, because I can. Places where I stick my nose will end up in the trash disposal. Oh, cruel, cruel fate. And I hear Hillary can't wait. When my puppy jewels are chopped on the block, she'll ask the doc to stay.
Hey, doc, you got a group rate?
And now back to Lindsay Beierstein interviewing Rachel Godsill.
Can white people get stereotype threat regarding their beliefs about their own of an inability to function and do the right thing and be decent functional people in interracial interactions?
That's exactly right. That is what Phil Goff has called white stereotype threat. And that's exactly what he identified in those police officers that I described at the beginning of our conversation. So it was the police officers who were worried that they would be perceived as racist who ended up, when they were in encounters on the street with people of other races, finding themselves using physical force more frequently than implicitly or even explicitly biased police officers. And Phil Goff's explanation for why that concern about being racist, which would seem like it would have the exact opposite effect, right? Because these are people who are worried about seeming racist. His theory is that police officers have two sources of authority, moral and physical. If you worry that someone won't respect your moral authority because they think you're racist, and if you worry that your behavior essentially might confirm the negative stereotype that you're racist and therefore that you are not moral, then you don't have that moral authority to work with. And that then leaves you only with the physical authority. And Phil Goff has actually been able to come up with interventions that have worked for police officers and have dramatically diminished the level of excessive use of force used by people who fit this profile by coming up with a set of actions that the police officers have to take. We call it the Goff Protocol, which will ensure that they are acting in a way that is not racist.
How does that work maybe with the teachers that are less willing to give feedback if they have stereotype threat about their ability to be just and consistent teachers? How might that affect their ability to give critical feedback?
Again, our hypothesis is that it is likely to have the exact same effect. And it's something that we're hoping to engage in more research and actually use some version of the diagnostic tools that Phil Goff used with police departments with teachers. There are some school districts who are actually quite enthusiastic about potentially working with social scientists to identify this, because it would be obviously enormously helpful to help teachers figure out what it is that's potentially preventing them from being their best selves with their students, and then their students from being able to be as academically successful as they could be. And the way that that protocol could easily be translated into the teaching context is simply to provide the tools that Claude Zeal, who identified the phenomenon of stereotype threat, has found to be very successful in providing interracial feedback. So essentially, if the Goff protocol in the policing context is, step one, make sure you're stopping someone for a valid reason. Step two, articulate to that person why you're stopping them. Step three, use a respectful tone. Step four, use no more force than is absolutely necessary. And step five, make sure that you read them the right. So, you know, if those are the five steps, that could easily be translated with teachers with, A, it is crucial for students to know that you have high expectations for them. Communicate that openly and often. Step two, it is crucial that students know why you think they're able to achieve those high expectations. So notice what the student has done or said or written that suggests that they're capable. Step three, students need to receive critical feedback so that they can improve. Make sure you communicate to the students wherever you see areas where they can improve and become even more successful. So it's finding very specific actions that teachers can take that are validated to them as ensuring that they are behaving in a non-biased way should provide, if you know, other research applies here, which it seems quite clear that it will, should provide the teachers the confidence that they're behaving in a way that conforms to their ideals for themselves to be non-racist, and that communicates to them, you don't have to worry that your actions will be perceived as racist, because if you do these things, you're behaving in a non-biased manner. In fact, you're being the best kind of teacher, and your students will appreciate that. And even if the individual student doesn't like your negative feedback, that's okay. Individual students might not, but we're telling you, and again, often you'll need to have a team that's diverse to validate successfully with racially anxious teachers, and I think that's an ideal in any event, that will be validated to them as the way to proceed that will protect them from the fear or the anxiety that they might be engaging in stereotypical behavior.
If someone's sitting at home and listening and saying, you know, what can I do right now to get my behavior to be better, what would you tell them to do? Are there websites, are there books, are there things like that that people can pursue right now?
The Perception Institute website, you know, our report is on the website, and our report goes into as much detail as a person could possibly want, but our report does actually, in the executive summary, summarize the reducing prejudice practices that Patricia Devine has identified. And so if someone really is excited about these ideas, and particularly if they're in the health, you know, say if they work in the healthcare context or as educators, I would urge them to take a look at the report, because all of this research is summarized and synthesized and translated so that it can be read and used and applied by someone immediately. And even if someone is interested who isn't in education or healthcare, the whole first section of the report just focuses on these dynamics. There also are groups who are beginning to emerge that are trying to create communities of people, all of whom are trying to reduce their bias. And so there's a fairly newly formed network called Within Our Lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're trying to do is to encourage people to understand and address implicit bias. They are encouraging people to take the implicit association test. I've been working with them, and I'm encouraging them, of course, to help people also focus on these other areas. Because the one concern that I have, which goes back to our discussion earlier about white privilege, is I do worry if people get too caught up in just thinking about whether or not they have bias,
mm-hmm.
they risk flipping over into the racially anxious category. And so while I think we do absolutely need to understand that we are likely to have implicit biases, and I do encourage people to take the implicit association test, which can be found on Harvard Project Implicit's website, and that has a whole host of implicit association tests that you can take, as well as, again, for people who really want to understand the research. But I do want to make sure that people recognize that the bias is one component, but to make sure that our behavior doesn't inadvertently either look like bias, because what's somewhat remarkable is the research describing how people behave when they are implicitly biased with someone of another race is actually almost identical to how people behave when they're racially anxious. So if what our focus is, what I think our focus should be, is changing our behaviors so that our interactions with people don't essentially cause them to feel as though they're being subjected to bias, even if they're not,
mm-hmm.
then being aware of the potential for racial anxiety to come into play is important too. And I think people who care enough, who are listening to all of this and who then jump on some of these websites and start thinking about this work, and if people are willing to do the work of Patricia Devine describes in Breaking the Prejudice Habit, doing all of that means that obviously a person cares a great deal about living their values. And doing the work of individuating, doing the work of seeking interracial interaction rather than being worried about how it will go, and understanding that you may have to have some humility in those moments, and there may be moments where you behave awkwardly, and that's okay so long as you kind of keep doing the work. All of that hopefully can minimize the sense of anxiety simply by affirming that a person is doing all that they can as an individual. So I guess a final point would be, I think it's wonderful that these interventions exist that people can undertake as individuals. Ultimately, we will not be successful in addressing the role that race plays simply by lots of individuals doing work. It's somewhat akin to dealing with air pollution by all of us having inhalers.
Mm-hmm.
We do need to deal with the race that's in the air more broadly, and that's dealing with the way race is portrayed in the media, that's dealing with the way that race can be used as a wedge in political discussions and creation of public policy. So there is a sort of structural, institutional component of all of this.
And changing the way our society creates differentials, like what percentage of people are in jail and what percentage of people are in poverty and that kind of stuff.
Exactly, yes. But I would add one thing that's been very illuminating but also extraordinarily distressing is to realize that the focus that the press often has, and even, frankly, those in civil rights equals social justice side of things, the focus we often place on portraying the disparities
mm-hmm.
attribute to people's association of those groups with the disparities. So if we look at the media, we see people of color, particularly African Americans, Latinos, portrayed as poor at far higher rates than they are in fact poor. So it's true that African Americans and Latinos are more likely to be poor than white, but there are actually more white people overall who are poor than Black and Latino.
Right.
And the reason that's important to realize is if we have these ideas of people in these racial and ethnic groups as, you know, poor and as likely to be incarcerated, then that creates the association of poor criminals. And
right.
cry. So many dying for a flag to fly. Everything can change in the blink of an eye. So we hope you make it home cut short. I've got the paper open with a stomach like lead, looking for your name in the list of the dead. But it's somebody's daughter or it's somebody's son, and it doesn't make a difference which country they're from. Soldier or insurgent, it hits home the same. Another family torn apart by the prophet. Got bombs on the road, you've got bombs in the sky. So many dying for a flag to fly. Everything can change in the blink of an eye. So we hope you make it home alive.
Now for something completely different.